Hey guys, welcome to Talk Nerdy. It's Monday, January 23rd, and as always, I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. I'm really pumped to be able to talk this week with Michael Marshall of the Merseyside Skeptic Society. He has some really special insights into a topic that is especially relevant. We recorded this prior to all of the news, what Kellyanne Conway was referring to Sean Spicer saying during a White House press event when he used quote-unquote alternative facts. And of course, as we know, fake news and now these quote alternative facts, aka lies, have been a big topic of conversation lately in American politics, but also at large. So Marsh is going to really kind of explain some of the unholy alliance, the really unethical relationship that currently exists between reporters or larger media outlets, even smaller ones, I suppose, and public relations companies, and exactly how we actually get the news that we get. It's just fascinating. But before we dive into that, I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week. As you know, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. And the way that we make it so is because of support by listeners like you. So if you were to visit patreon.com/talknerdy, you could pledge your support. And at different levels, you get different perks. And of course, it helps the show continue to improve and stay on the air. The top supporters this week are Mark Hepburn, Phil Tebear, Timothy Glover, Christian Jeffrey, David Lacer, Jeffrey Perez, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Stuart Ogg, The Honorable Husband, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you guys so much. And remember, there's other ways you can support the show. Just visit my website, carasantamaria.com. Click all around. You'll see lots of things. We've got a Talk Nerdy store with fun t-shirts and handmade leather goods and mugs. And oh, it's awesome. So yeah, that's enough of my spiel. I am super pumped about this week's episode. So without any further ado, here he is, Michael Marshall. Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me on. It's a pleasure to be on.
Yeah. So how often do people actually call you Michael anymore? Does just everybody call you Marsh?
I think everybody calls me Marsh. I don't think there's many people who call me Michael. In fact, my wife gets very confused by anyone calling me Michael because she's never called me Michael. Her entire, the entire 8 years we've been together, she's called me Marsh. Right to a point where we went on our honeymoon to Japan and had to kind of put our names on passes for the trains. And she managed to spell Michael wrong on the train pass. I said, well, it's 8 years in and we're married. You should know my name by this point, but I'll allow that one to slide.
But your family must call you Michael, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I think I come from a very kind of nickname-y place, really. So I'll answer to pretty much anything. And I was kind of, I've been a Michael, I've been a Mickey, I've been a Mick and a Mike. But I just figured there's too many Mikes knocking around skepticism, especially in Merseyside Skeptics, where I start off in skepticism, which is run by Mike Hall, who's the president. So I thought I'll make an easy distinguish early on and go by a different name. And it's kind of stuck and at times become a rod for my own back. And I have to kind of explain to people why I'm going by a nickname in these ways.
I love it. I think it's a cool nickname. I'm one of those people who never really got a nickname because my name is short. I don't know. You can't really shorten Kara. And I don't know that I just think there's not a traditional nickname for Kara, so everybody just calls me
true.
Kara.
Although if you'd grown up in Liverpool, it would be Kaza, I think. Liverpool or Australia, it might have been Kaz or Kaza. Neither of those are particularly attractive noises to so you've escaped that one.
Yeah, seriously. I guess the closest thing is that a lot of people are just out of the blue, like independently call me CSM. They just really like my initials. That's a standard way for me to go. So I'll take
really?
It.
That sounds very kind of official, though. I think it kind of sounds almost kind of formal or imposing almost to
isn't
be CSM.
Yeah, I think it's just weird to people that my last name is two words, so they want to make sure it's emphasized or something. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it because, like, the DMV, all the different places where you have to have your name officially put in a document, they always fuck it up. So I'm pleased with that. So anyway, you mentioned Merseyside skeptics, and I have to say, when I came last year to QED, which is a conference that you are like heavily, heavily involved in, I kept hearing this term thrown around, the Merseyside skeptics, Merseyside skeptics, and just kind of smiled and nodded. Like, I had no idea that that was like English. And so now I know Merseyside refers to a location, right?
Yes, yes. It is the county that is on the side of the Mersey being the river that Liverpool, where I live, is based on. So anybody who kind of knows the sort of 60s, 70s era of music coming out of Liverpool will have heard of the song Ferry Across the Mersey, and that's because the Mersey is the river there, and the county is the bits on the side of that. And we set up, so I'm from the Merseyside Skeptic Society, which is the skeptic society that I set up with a couple of my colleagues there in 2009, and we decided to set up as Merseyside rather than Liverpool, just so we can start ourselves thinking bigger than just being a city that puts on a skeptics in the pub. We decided to kind of be almost pretentiously initially be bigger than that and kind of set our sights and our goals higher. And it was only a couple of years later that we were doing QED, and I'd run the 1023 campaign, which had kind of made international news and had did all these bizarre things, because we'd always kind of set our sights as being a skeptic society that does skeptical things, including events, rather than being an event organizer kind of thing.
I like it. But, you know, Manchester, where you held QED, I guess, do you always hold QED in Manchester?
Yes, we do. Yeah. So we it's kind of jointly run by members of the Merseyside Skeptics and members of the Greater Manchester Skeptic Society. And Manchester is just a bigger city and more accessible. As much as there's a huge rivalry between Liverpool and Manchester, and as an adopted Liverpudlian, I'm very much on the Liverpool side of that rivalry. But sometimes pragmatics and logistics dictate where you have to be. And Manchester is just it's a much easier place to get to kind of anybody coming from around the world. And we get people coming in from Australia and America and all around the world. So we have to kind of think of our international people just as much as our local rivalries.
And they're not that far apart from one another. I know this because I'm actively looking at a map right now. There's no way I would have known that on my own.
Well, they're not far apart for an American, but they're quite far apart for an Englishman, because it's an hour drive in England, you know, is a significant proportion of the time it would take to get end to end in the country. I think you can drive end to end in this entire country in about 10 hours or 11 hours or something like that. So 10% of that's a significant amount. Whereas obviously in America, you guys can drive for like 3 months straight and never hit land and never hit sea, rather.
That's definitely true. I remember when I first moved, I was born and raised in Texas. And when I moved from Texas to New York for the first time, I was blown away that you could go to different states over the course of just a few hours. Because in Texas, you can drive for 18 hours end to end in Texas in one state.
That is incredible.
Crazy?
I mean, that's too big.
It's too big. I know it's too big. And of course, now in California, it's the same thing. If you want to go from Southern California to Northern California, it's definitely a different mentality out here and a different lifestyle. Although I hardly ever leave Los Angeles. So maybe it is a little, still a little like the UK, except of course it's always sunny here.
Yeah, you get some sunshine now and then, which is a rarity for us. Absolutely.
That's true. When I showed up to Manchester the very first day for QED this past year, Andy greeted me by the car, or no, Andy drove me from the airport, and I was like, oh, look, it's raining. And he was like, yeah, welcome to Manchester.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I think it's rained like consistently all the way through every QED we've ever had. And we've moved it around the year, and it's the same weather every single time. Manchester's particularly rainy. Yeah.
I love it, though. I mean, it's a nice change of pace for me. Maybe it would be difficult if it was like that all the time, but I absolutely loved it. And I had so much fun at QED. There were so many great speakers. There were like incredible people from all, like you said, all over the world. There was a really supportive group, and and not, you know, terribly dissimilar from skeptic gatherings that I've been to time and time again here in the States, but also definitely had its own vibe, its own flavor. And I don't know, I think it was a little bit like more community. It was a little nicer. I felt a little more at home there than in some of the skeptic gatherings here. So it was just a great experience for me.
Oh, that's very nice of you to say so. Yeah, I mean, that's very much what we've always had in mind for QED, really, is an event based around, first and foremost, the attendees. And it's kind of like, I mean, you as a speaker, in our minds, you're there to serve the attendees to a degree. It's kind of like the reason that the person is on stage is because there's 600 people in the audience who've kind of paid their tickets to be able to make this whole event work. And we try and kind of have as much of that kind of spirit in our speakers, in our kind of like panels and podcasts and things. We try and get that. We try and invite people who we think will get that and enjoy that. And that's kind of all the way we try and always design things. And I think because we do it that way, a lot of the people who attend get that same feeling out of it, that this is an event for the attendees, it's an event for the community, and it's kind of, it's their event as much as it is ours. And I always love the atmosphere of QED, and it's one of the things that makes me so proud, seeing the feedback and the way that people respond to it. People really get what we're trying to do, I think.
Yeah, it's wonderful. So how long have you really been actively sort of engaged in the skeptic community?
I think it would have been around about, well, I started the Merseyside Skeptics in 2009. So, and that kind of came a bit out of the blue, really. So I think I've been listening to like podcasts and things like that. So I've been kind of a passive skeptic for maybe a year or so before that. And I just happened to Google as to whether there was a skeptical group in Liverpool. And the only thing I found was this stranger's picture on the internet saying, is there a skeptical group in Liverpool? And so I dropped him a line out of the blue and said, I'm really interested. Should we start something? And it was on meetup.com. And he looked at me, looked at my profile on Meetup and thought I was the craziest person, because he looked at what I was interested in. And I was interested in horoscopes, and I was interested in ghosts, and I was interested in psychics and Reiki and alternative medicine. And he thought, this person is absolutely crazy. He believes every single piece of bullshit going. Whereas I am interested in those things. I just don't believe that they're real, but I'm still very interested in them. I want to immerse myself in people who do believe in them, so I can understand why people believe and what it is that's so convincing about it, and what kind of arguments are made, so that when I talk to people who believe in those things and who might be reachable, I know the arguments that they'll have heard, and I might have had counter arguments in my head. So I'm very interested in all the things. But he just thought, Christ, we've got an absolute nutter who's going to come along and set this group up. But that was February 2009, and we've been sort of putting on events ever since then. And it was less than a year later that we actually did our big homeopathy overdose for the 1023 campaign, which, looking back, I think is bizarre to think it was less than a year. And I think it was very much the arrogance of ignorance, essentially, is that we did not know what we were taking on, and that allowed us to be able to do it. Because had we thought for a second what we were doing at the time, I have no idea what we, I don't think we'd have been able to do it. I think we'd have been sort of frozen by kind of fear and things.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, because I think within skeptic circles, the 1023 campaign is a well-known thing. And I think that rightly so, you guys are lauded with this incredible kind of win. But outside of skeptic circles, and perhaps even just outside of the UK, which I do have quite a few UK listeners, quite a few Australian listeners, and even many listeners from non-English dominant countries. But obviously, the bulk of my listeners here on Talk Nerdy are American. Some individuals may not know what you're referring to, what this fight against homeopathy was. Do you think you can give us a little bit of a summary?
Yeah, I mean, so the short version of it really was that it was around about the time that Simon Singh was being sued for by the British Chiropractic Association. And so all the skeptics in the UK were turning their attention to chiropractic. And we thought, well, we can either become one voice doing that, or we can see what else is out there and try and affect that at the same time while everyone's fighting this other battle. And we decided to pick homeopathy because, you know, homeopathy is such a cartoonishly obvious pseudoscience when you know the science of it. There's no way that homeopathy could possibly work. It's based on the idea that the more you dilute something, the stronger it gets. And, you know, every child who's ever drank squash at the age of five, drunk watered down fruit juice will tell you, you dilute things, it gets weaker, it gets less tasty. You know, it's an argument that can be refuted by a five-year-old. But this was still, you know, being given out on the National Health Service in the UK, and it was available in pharmacies. So we decided, rather than fight the science, because the science has been in on homeopathy for more than a century, and clearly just having scientific papers debunking homeopathy wasn't enough to convince people it didn't work, because people are still buying it. So we thought, rather than do the science, we'll do a PR stunt. to advertise the fact that homeopathy doesn't work, that to advertise the fact that the evidence shows it doesn't work. And so we got people initially all around the UK to go into their local pharmacy and buy some homeopathic medicine, and then stand outside of their local pharmacy, and everybody all together at precisely the same time would take an overdose of that that homeopathic medicine all around the UK to prove that these are just sugar pills. They're not going to harm anyone. And so we had, I think, 300 people in 13 cities, and the overdose took place at 10:23 in the morning and was called the 10:23 campaign. And it was kind of a strategic point that I'll kind of come into what we're, it'll be useful for what we're talking about in the rest of the interview, I guess, because the reason we called the campaign 10:23 was because we identified that whenever the media talks about homeopathy, they don't tell you there's nothing in it. They say it's ultra dilute or it's very dilute, there's barely anything in. They don't say there's nothing in it. So we thought, how do we force the media to tell the real story here? And so we called the campaign 10:23 after the Avogadro limit, the chemical principle that shows that when you dilute something past a certain point, it is now just water. You're not going to find any molecules of the original substance. Mm-hmm. And that Avogadro limit is 6.02 × 10²³. So we thought, if we call our campaign 10:23 and we do it at 10:23 a.m. specifically, the media can't possibly report on this without explaining what that weird number means. So every single newspaper, and this is front page of the BBC, and it was in the Guardian, the Mail, the print versions of every national newspaper in the UK, every single one of them included a line saying the campaign group, which takes its name from the chemical principle that shows there is nothing in homeopathy, did such and such a thing. So we managed to crowbar genuine science in by thinking about the way that the media is going to report on what we're doing and how we can sort of take advantage of that. And it was quite successful in the UK. It was even more successful the next year when we did it internationally. We had 1,700 people in 70 cities across 32 countries, including someone who was in Antarctica taking a homeopathic overdose, which was amazing. But we found out afterwards the little effects that we didn't anticipate. Sales of homeopathy in Poland dropped by 17% after the 10:23 campaign. You can track the sales and it just drops off a cliff, you know, by almost a fifth. Because we weren't telling people this doesn't work. We were showing people, we were directing them towards the evidence that already existed by doing this big public stunt, because most people don't know what it is. Most people think homeopathy is herbal, natural medicine. It's all that kind of stuff. The moment you tell people, no, this stuff is, you know, based on the idea that diluting stuff makes it stronger and things like that, people start realizing that this, that it just doesn't work. So yeah, advertising the evidence was the main goal. And in that way, it was pretty useful, really.
Very cool. And where is kind of the public consciousness now? Where are the laws in the UK with regards to homeopathy? Is it still freely legal? Do you find it on pharmacy shelves? Is there any regulation of homeopaths? Kind of how does it compare to, you know, some of the things we're up against here in the US?
I think there are probably some similarities. Certainly in terms of regulation of homeopaths, it's relatively lax, really. I mean, anybody can set up as a homeopath. It's not a protected term. It's not even like there is a sort of a good you know, state regulator of homeopaths in the same way there is a regulator of doctors. I mean, you've got things like the Society of Homeopaths, but they're not very effective as a regulator because they are made up of homeopaths.
Yeah.
So, you know, they are there first of all to serve the industry. You can still get homeopathy in pharmacies, but I think something I've noticed in the sort of, what is it now, 8 years since we started our campaign about homeopathy is that the amount of homeopathy in the big pharmacy chains in the UK, and Boots in particular are the biggest pharmacy chain in the UK, the amount of homeopathy there has, I think, significantly decreased, significantly shrunk. And I think part of that might be a lowering of demand as more and more negative press exists around homeopathy. And then you have the NHS funding for homeopathy, which a couple of years ago, people literally, there was nobody in the entire country knew how much government money was being spent giving sugar pills to sick people, because it was nobody's job in the government to collate those figures. All the decisions were made at local levels, and never did anybody at a national level collate the figures. So once I started working for the Good Thinking Society, which is a skeptical charity here in the UK, headed up by Simon Singh, and I work full time there. It's my full time job being a skeptic, which is a interesting and bizarre position to be in. It meant that I could now actually start asking individual health boards around the country how much they spent and collate those figures. And we as a charity were the first group in the entire country to know that the UK was spending £5 million on homeopathy. And but over the course of the last 2.5 years, we've been challenging that bit by bit. And we've had some big successes. It's been stopped in Liverpool, where I live, and the Wirral, just near where I live. It's been stopped in the entire northeast of England. And in the meantime, other parts of the NHS have started to dump it. Partly, I think, because the public opinion, will for homeopathy is diminishing. Partly, I think, because doctors are becoming a bit more bold in being able to say, we need to stop wasting money here. Mm. But I think, if I'm being realistic, it's probably that our National Health Service is generally quite underfunded and seemingly increasingly underfunded. And I think at the point where the doctors are the ones writing the checks, when they know that it's coming out of their budgets and they know that their budgets have got to stretch, it's no surprise that they get rid of the thing that they know doesn't work amongst one of the first kind of things to go. So lots of factors have played in, but certainly the fact that we spent the last kind of, well, 2.5 years or 3 years of my work with Good Thinking, and broader than that, kind of 7 years of my work with Merseyside Skeptics, and broader than that, the last 15, 20 years of skeptics all around the country sort of doing lots of different things, has started to constrain and shrink the spending of homeopathy. And hopefully we'll be able to keep that pressure up, not just kind of highlighting where the homeopaths are doing stuff terribly wrong, but also kind of making the average person on the street aware of what homeopathy actually is. And that will be the death knell, hopefully, to homeopathy. You know, awareness of homeopathy and knowledge of homeopathy are the two biggest threats to continual buying of homeopathy.
Seriously, just knowing that homeopathy is very different than what you might think of as, quote, herbal medicine or vitamins. You know, I think a lot of people out the gate don't even know what the word means. And then once they actually do start to research it and understand that it's not just some other form of, quote unquote, alternative medicine, but it's like the most blatant, the most obvious, and it actually means something if it says homeopathy on a package. It means, like we said, that it's been diluted, you know, X amount of times until there's nothing left in it. Once people realize that, they're like, wait, what? Wait,
yeah, it's absolutely true.
That's what I'm taking. But how cool is it that you've been able to dedicate yourself full time, that the Good Thinking Society has been able to, you know, fundraise enough to have individuals on staff that can really put all of their efforts into this? What is your actual role there?
So I'm the project director, but basically because we're such a small group, I mean, it's Simon Singh's our head, and he kind of is able to put in a day or two a week doing it. Mm-hmm. I have a colleague, Laura Thomason, who's our kind of, she's a project manager, but she's really our regulatory body, our kind of complaint maker. She just knows the way that regulations work in terms of all of the different, you know, things like alternative medicines and the way that media regulations work. So when a complaint needs to be made, Laura has the diligence to know exactly how to write it. And she works part-time. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of Good Thinking is sort of me full-time. So project director is kind of a fairly grand-looking title for essentially whatever needs to happen.
But
and that might be that I spend a lot of my time giving talks around the country,
yeah,
to skeptics groups, and I do a lot of work where I go in undercover to see exactly what claims are being made by this particular alternative therapist when they think they're talking to somebody with this particular set of conditions. And I go along to mind, body, spirit festivals, and then sometimes I have to meet with MPs and meet with we met with the BBC a couple of weeks ago to talk about their science output and their coverage of pseudoscience. And it's kind of a bit of anything really, which is a really nice position to be in as a skeptic, where you get to sort of follow your nose where you think, you know, it leads you, where the story might lead you, and where you think you can be most effective. But also you're kind of very aware that there aren't many people in the world in the position to be able to do this stuff full time. And you want to make the best of it that you can, really, and make sure you're being as effective as possible.
Absolutely. How fun and fascinating to be able to dedicate all of your time to that. You must be able to get very creative about new approaches and kind of keep your finger on the pulse of what matters, what's important, and where you can be the most effective. And one place that you actually do dedicate a fair amount of your time, I'm not sure if you do it under the umbrella of the Good Thinking Society or if you actually do it kind of in your spare time, whatever that means, is the work that you're doing on bad PR, which is just fascinating. And I can't wait to, I just want to spend the rest of the time talking about this because it's so, I think, underreported and underknown.
Yeah, it's something that I sort of took on as a hobby I guess the first couple of years in skepticism. Actually, I read the book Flat Earth News by Nick Davies. And Nick Davies is a hugely respected Guardian journalist who retired from the Guardian very recently. And the whole book looks at the way that news is made and how non-stories make the news. And it fascinated me to see kind of the mechanisms of newspapers laid out and the kind of forces and factors that go into why a story gets published and why it doesn't get published. And it's as you'll know yourself working in the media, some of those things are incredibly shocking. And I think it kind of it got me looking into it there, and it's become something of an obsession ever since. And I've kind of, looked in a million different areas of this. And it's one of those things, I think, that every layer of the story just seems to add an extra set of complications, an extra set of craziness, an extra set of crazy little kind of elements, and an extra set of pressures. And it's every wheel in the cog seems to be broken in some way or another. And I love to be able to talk people through it. I actually get brought in occasionally to universities on their journalism course to actually take a guest lecture and to lecture journalism students and PR students on exactly what the journalism industry is actually up to right now, what it is to be a journalist and what you have to cope with. And you can kind of see their dreams crush in front of your eyes when you take through quite what's happening.
Well, sure, because I think that we're so used to, both in science and journalism, having these kind of rose-colored glasses, this sort of historical view of the ethos of the journalist or the ethics of the hardworking scientist. And, you know, this is the way it is. This is how the scientific method works, or this is the way that you report on a story. And for the most part, everybody is, well, I think the good ones at least, are striving to like go back to that kind of purest approach. But unfortunately, there's just a lot of garbage out there mucking things up. And I think maybe the most important thing to this story or this kind of approach that we're seeing time and time again with modern journalism and sort of its unholy alliance with PR companies is the fact that sometimes you really can't parse these two things apart. What makes you interested in this? I mean, obviously you've got this skeptical bent. This is something that you've been able to really focus on. Did you previously work in PR? How do you have kind of the inside knowledge to even know this is an issue?
It's I guess partly because I've just been looking into it as a hobby, but I guess it kind of borders on my career just before Good Thinking, really. So I spent 10 years in marketing, and it's kind of digital marketing, kind of not consumer based stuff, but you brush up against PR and you brush up against PR people in that time, and you hear incredible stories. And it's stories that people would share as kind of a badge of honor of how good they are. I always remember one story kind of sticks in my mind. It was midway through kind of my time looking into PR and things like that. And I was chatting to this one guy who worked for a PR company, and he didn't actually know what I do in my spare time because I didn't talk about it. So he thought he was just talking to somebody at a kind of a, not a competitive firm, but someone who'd been a company that's kind of adjacent. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about how one of his clients was a trucking company, and there was a crash, and one of his clients' trucks were involved. And so the first thing he did was phone up the local newspaper and say, I'll give you every single piece of information about this crash if you keep the name of my client out of the story. So you say a truck's crashed, but you don't say what who the truck belonged to, you know, what company the truck was from.
Interesting.
And I'll give you everything. If you put the name of the company in there, you won't get any more stories from me in the future. And so because they've got this relationship with a local journalist who, as we'll get into, pressures on journalism are incredibly high because costs are incredibly low, you know, the amount of investment rather is incredibly low. If you're a local journalist and you know that this PR company might give you a couple of stories a month, do you want to turn that tap off for the detail of putting in what the company involved in the crash was? You probably don't, but you're making a decision at that point to miss out part of the truth in order to keep getting this supply of stories in the future. And it at that point, you've compromised the ethics of journalism to a degree where you're bound to tell as much truth as possible, tell the truth that you have. You're doing that because this relationship you have with PR. So stories like that absolutely fascinate me.
Yeah. It worries, I think, me, having been somebody who's worked on both sides of this sort of equation. I've worked as a scientist. I didn't have that much connection with the journalistic world back when I was working as a scientist, because I was still a student through most of my study. So I was never the person that, you know, somebody would reach out to. They would reach out to my major professor. I might be the one doing the work, but he's going to be the one publicly talking about it. We also didn't really ever do anything that interesting or important. So we just kind of weren't on anybody's radar. But then when I moved over into media and have actually worked as a journalist and sort of had to learn the ropes as I went, because I didn't go to J school. I studied science in school. It seems like, okay, when I started reading your blog and I was reading about some of the things that happen, there is a part of me that goes, obviously this is what happens because people are greedy and they're smart and they're going to try and cover their tracks, or they're going to try and get their product sold, or whatever the case may be. Obviously this happens because if you're good at your job, you're going to try to make this happen. But at the same time, it's just crushing that this happens, like that this is allowed to happen. So maybe for people who, I assume most people know what PR is, but maybe I shouldn't make that assumption. What's a good way, I guess, to define what the kind of PR machine out there is? What does it entail? What does it do? I know it from a Hollywood perspective, but I think a lot of people don't really know that PR is utilize for products and for movements and for all sorts of things.
Yeah. So, I mean, at its heart, there's nothing wrong with PR, I don't think. Mm-hmm. So PR is just a way for an organization or a company or a body to get the message that they want out there, to make sure that journalists are featuring the side of their company that they want the world to see. And that can be done incredibly ethically. You know, you see charities will do fantastic work telling the world about this particular initiative they might have to, you know, build functioning toilets in this particular country in Africa. Mm-hmm. And that story doesn't get told because journalists go out to that country and look to stumble across someone. That story gets told because a charity will say, hey, this is what we're doing. Here's all the information about it. If you want to talk to someone, here's the person who's a spokesperson. That's a PR job. It's kind of public relations. It's liaising with the press in order to get your message out.
Yeah,
and
even universities.
Be a very valuable thing.
Yeah, universities have their own person on staff, generally speaking. They don't call them a PR person. They don't call it public relations. But in many ways, that's what it is. It's an individual who writes press releases around what labs are doing and tries to send it out to the journalists so that their lab work can get some press.
Yeah, absolutely. Although there are problems as well with university press departments that often the people involved in the press departments aren't as well trained in the science that they're writing about as the people who are handing them the science. And so we can end up in a position where you'll do the science, you'll say, well, this is kind of my finding. And you might think, well, this is the best way of presenting my finding. And then you hand that to the press office and then they read that and go, well, this is the best way of presenting the way you presented it.
Yep.
And then that goes out to a journalist who puts another spin on that. And you can end up 5-6 layers deep in spin because there is this kind of disconnect from the initial science.
Absolutely.
So there are problems there.
Or you get the opposite problem where the journalist is lazy enough to say, I'm not really going to write around this. I'm basically just going to repackage this press release and I'm not going to dig any deeper and I'm going to take everything they say at face value, and then you just get basically press written journalism, which is not good.
Well, this is it, actually. You bring up a term that I always try and avoid as much as possible, and that's the assumption that journalists are lazy. And it's something that everyone will kind of say is, oh, these lazy journalists, they didn't check their facts, they didn't do that. But to really dig into what it is to be a journalist today, you have to look at what pressures are on them. And there was this absolutely fantastic study by Cardiff University in 2008. Mm-hmm. It was Williams et al., I think it was, who looked at the amount of copy output journalists have to do today compared to their counterparts sort of 20 years before that. So 1988, I guess it would have been. What they found is that journalists today are writing 3 times as much copy per day as their counterparts would have had to have done at the time back then. And obviously, if you've still got the same number of hours in the day, but you're expected to write 3 times as much copy, and this was in 2008 before blogs were as big, before the online world was even as big as it is now. Mm. It was a little bit smaller then. So I imagine that would have even gone up further as kind of the pressure of immediacy is on you to get things up onto the web as quickly as possible, and to have audio content and video content and the whole kind of multimedia stuff that journalists are largely expected to be involved in now. If you're expected to do all of that, three times as much as you would have had to done 20, 30 years ago. The thing that you lose is the ability to fact check. You lose the ability to source your own stories. And so what will happen is you end up with journalists under pressure to fill their quota for the day. And that might not be as high a pressure in science journalism, where you've got often skilled science writers, you've got a bit more of a remit to find stories, or who know how to find the right kind of stories. Yeah. But if you look at your more general journalism, and the good example of this, and it's never been called a good example of anything before, is the Mail Online. And it's an excellent example because it's the biggest news online publication in the world, and publishes easily, I would say, the most stories per day. It's something like 300 stories a day go out on the Mail Online, something in that kind of order. Often you'll find the journalists who are writing the majority of these stories won't be your seasoned 15 years in the job, know their way around the world kind of story journalists. They're often journalists who are 2 or 3, maybe 4 years out of university.
Yeah.
And if you're writing 4, 5, 6 stories a day and you haven't got that level of experience behind you, you're going to be under pressure from almost certainly quite an aggressive editor who's going to be down your throat if you don't file all your copy for the day, but won't care if you do file your copy, whether you've used copy that you didn't write. And so if you're a journalist under those kind of pressures, and then you get hundreds of emails every single day from PR companies trying to give you stories, there's going to become a point where you think, well, why would I need to put... why do I put my career on the line and take the stress of this rather than just publishing this one story that I got given pretty much as is? Maybe I'll add a little bit here and there, or maybe I'll change the words around to fit the house style. But I'm not going to do the substantive research behind it to see, is this story even true? And this was something we found actually going back to the 1023 campaign. We were front page of the BBC News the entire day. We were in every single national newspaper. I didn't speak to a single national newspaper. I didn't speak to the BBC. Despite being on the front page, I gave one interview to the Press Association at about 5 to 9 in that morning. And that's the one that ran everywhere.
Hmm.
That's one that had the quotes in, that had the story. Basically, the Press Association's copy went up verbatim right across the news media. And the only news outlet that phoned me to check if it even happened, whether this was even true, was the Scottish Herald, which is not a massive newspaper. I think it was a Scottish Herald, or well, certainly it was a Scottish newspaper. And so it absolutely fascinates me that, especially given that in the fortnight before the 1023 campaign, I spent most of my days trying to get the media interested in this story, calling up every different aspect of the local media that I could, you know, BBC Liverpool, BBC News Desk, BBC Health, the radio, the TV. Not one of them would commit to coming along and actually seeing this story for themselves. But the second I gave an interview to the Press Association, which is a newswire, that's the one that went absolutely everywhere, and no one bothered to check it, pretty much. And that's because we have the pressures of immediacy that you have to publish. Certainly it wasn't that long ago, and it's probably still true now, that immediacy trumps accuracy, that it's better to be wrong and first rather than right and last, because you've got if you're wrong and the first one to publish it, at least you get all the clicks, you get all the eyeballs on that. And that's worth a lot when advertising revenue is almost non-existent, and when funding in the industry is almost non-existent because nobody buys newspapers.
It's true.
So it's kind of a mess.
Yeah, it's a lot deeper than just, oh, an individual journalist is lazy. I mean, obviously, when you break it down, that's not what's happening. It's about having a lot of pressures. I think it's that the culture of journalism has gotten to be beholden to pressures that aren't always in line with what we think of as traditional journalistic ethics. The problem is that only the independent newspapers, only the independent television stations kind of are afforded that luxury. I work for an independent television station here in Los Angeles. It used to be a part of PBS. They lost their affiliation. So now it's just kind of apparently, I think, the nation's largest independent TV station, meaning that we don't have advertisers. It's, you know, everything's funded by viewers like you. And we do pledge drives and things like that. And so in many ways, we're lucky because we get to be decoupled from the advertisers. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that we don't have PR agencies reaching out to us. That doesn't mean that I don't sometimes get interviews based on recommendations by publicists. Same as on the podcast. I'll oftentimes interview a new author because a publicist reached out to me, sent me their book that I may not have even heard about before. And you still have pressures from within the organization. So even when you're protected from those heavy pressures, like sort of what we think of as advertising pressures, even within the organization, you are often still experiencing, well, what is the news director more interested in? Or what does the station manager think is important right now? Or, you know, what do my listeners or my viewers want to hear about? And so you still can find yourself working hard to avoid the echo chamber. Like, I don't think anybody's immune to it. But I think some of the most egregious examples are when an obvious sort of corporate or profit-seeking entity does its own quote-unquote science or does its own investigation, whatever you might want to call that. There's definitely air quotes about that, and then writes up a press release, and then somehow that gets published in a legitimate newspaper as just truth or fact with no kind of fact-checking around it.
Yeah, that's. I think that's exactly it. And as I say, I can understand, if not forgive, why a journalist wouldn't do the fact-checking if you just simply don't have the time. If you are a junior journalist who's got five stories written and it's 10 minutes to the deadline, you can either not have written one of those stories. Sorry, you can either not write your final story and get it in the next from your editor, or you can pick what looks to be the best-looking story in your inbox from the PR companies that day and fill your quota and never get in trouble. So I can understand that kind of pressure. I could even understand whether there were journalists who said, well, okay, I need to write six stories today. I'll pick the three best looking press releases from my inbox and do minimal editing to those. And then I'll have the rest of the day to spend doing three really good stories. Mm. And I'll really put my heart and soul into making sure that those stories are good. And I've done some great journalism on those three stories. And to pay for that, I've printed three press releases verbatim, basically. But half of your output at that point has been garbage. Half of your output is something you haven't checked. And that's true right across the board. So I can sort of understand how people get there, but you can't forgive the effect that it has. And I think the other thing you have to bear in mind too is that because there are far, far fewer journalists these days than there were sort of 20 years ago, because there isn't the funding in journalism. People like Rupert Murdoch would buy up a newspaper and immediately try and make money from it because he's a businessman. So the first thing he does is try and lay off staff who he thinks aren't necessary. Yeah. So you lower the number of people who are the overheads. Why have someone sat in a courtroom every day reporting on court cases when you can sack the court reporter and have a general journalist call the courtroom at the end of the day to say, what were your top three stories or what were the big cases? Could you send through kind of the reports on your big cases kind of thing? So you don't need a specialist journalist there to be able to tell what's a good story, what's a valid story and what's not. You don't need a specialist journalist there anymore to say, actually, the way that this is being reported by the court isn't quite what you would have interpreted had you been there in the room.
Mm-hmm.
All that specialism gets lost. But because there are fewer people, there are now fewer people in journalism. Now, the people who would have gone into journalism are doing something with their lives. They're in PR. As journalism shrinks in terms of sort of the headcount, PR has absolutely boomed because those people are going somewhere. And so you now have a lot of people who are trained journalists in the sense that they went to kind of university to a journalism degree, can't get into journalism because there's just no jobs there and no money there, but they can get into PR. But they are now taught the mechanisms of journalism, the mechanisms of newspapers, and are now in the position of kind of the gatekeeper turned poacher, as it were. And I think that's a real kind of problem. And one of the fascinating things that PR companies do now, there's a million different things that they do to try and make their incident rate higher in terms of getting their stuff published. And one of them is what you do is you understand the publication you're trying to get your story placed into, and you write it as much like one of their stories as possible. So gone are the days where you write a press release, you know, however you want. You know, the Merseyside Skeptic Society announced such and such a campaign, and here's three paragraphs about how great we are. Mm-hmm. Instead of writing it that way, you write it as if you'd see it appearing in the newspaper. But still gone are the days where you'd write that and send it to a million different newspapers at once and see which ones pick them up. You now write and tailor your press release to every different publication you're writing to. And if you do that, it already looks like a Daily Mail story, or it already looks like a story in The Telegraph. It's much more likely to get published that way because you've got under-pressure journalists who can see a story that looks like one of theirs.
And it's smart. It's obviously a smart thing to do, and it's effective, and it makes sense. It's the same way that when we're teaching science communication, one of the biggest kind of notes that we give scientists is think about what the journalists are after. You're much less likely to be misquoted in a news report about your science if you're just rambling on or if you're using a lot of jargon. Try and give them the clean quote. Think about what they're looking for so that you can sort of control the message. It's smart. It's the way that it makes sense to approach it. The problem is when it butts up against the ethics of what journalists historically did and what they really should do, which is, as we keep saying, fact-checking, which is corroborating mm-hmm. the evidence, which is making sure that what's being said isn't already spun, but is actually truth. I want to take a quick break to thank this week's sponsors. Well, guys, I'm so excited to be partnered once again this week with Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Now, Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. And I am a testament to that because I am not a chef. I have no idea what I'm doing in the kitchen, and I'm absolutely uncreative when it comes to food, but it's so easy to make a really, really good meal that is something I would never think to do on my own otherwise. The great thing is Blue Apron can be delivered to 99% of the continental U.S., and this is how it works. Let me just break it down for you. You get a box in the mail, and that box has every ingredient you could possibly need to make an incredible meal for yourself and your family. And there's no waste. There's nothing in there that you're not going to use. It's the exact amount called for by the recipe. They're these beautiful full-color recipe cards that go step-by-step with how to make the meal. And it's such a fun way that you can bond in the kitchen. So what are you guys waiting for? It's only $10 per person for a really good meal, like mushroom and chipotle pepper enchiladas with lime sour cream, or pork chops and garlic with scallion rice and spinach. Guys, all you have to do is visit this website, blueapron.com/nerdy, and you get a lot for visiting. You get your first 3 meals for free, and you also get free shipping. All you got to do is go to blueapron.com/nerdy. Once again, that's blueapron.com/nerdy. All right, let's get back to the show.
And I think that there's another kind of wrinkle to the system when you bring in another agent to this. So you've got your journalists, you've got your PR companies. You also have news agencies like the Press Association, Associated Press, people like that, the Newswires. And those have been very reliable for newspapers for a long, long time as a way of getting the starting points of stories. So rather than, the Times having someone in Zimbabwe to report on Robert Mugabe's latest speech, the news agency would have someone there, and then they send their report back saying, this is what happened. But when you look at what the remit of a news agency is, it's that they're supposed to report accurately rather than truthfully. Their aim is for accuracy rather than truth. And that feels like a technical distinction until you consider the real-world ramifications. So let's say Robert Mugabe gives a speech tomorrow and says, I'm the greatest African president any country's ever seen. I've done nothing but good for my people. If you can report that accurately, you say, well, here's where his speech took place. Here's how many people were there. Here's what time it started. And here's the words that he said.
Yep.
And then if you're going to report it truthfully, you say why he's lying. But if your onus is only on the former, not the latter, then you aren't telling that story. You aren't doing proper journalism. You're just reporting, as it were. And what we found, unfortunately, is that when the pressures are upon journalists to get stuff published out there as quickly as possible, because they've got a million other things to do, they aren't taking, when they take news agency copy, they aren't doing the background and the contextualization and the fact checking to turn those accurate reports into truthful reports. They're just going straight out from the newswire. And then you consider the fact that the Newswire are under exactly the same financial pressures as journalists, because as newspapers rather, because no one buys newspapers anymore, really, comparatively, which means their revenues are down, which means they can't afford to pay the Newswires as much anymore. So the Newswires need to cut costs. And so not only is PR getting into the newspapers directly, it's getting into the Newswires, which then pass into the newspapers without any checking, because we know that the Newswires are sound because they are responsible and they do their job. So long as they're doing their job right, we as journalists can trust them more than this random press release that came in from a PR company I've never heard of before. So even the newswire element, once you bring that in, adds in another complexity, another wrinkle of people trying to do their job under the best of, under the worst of conditions, the best that they can, and having these gaps that are then being exploited in these unfortunate ways too.
Well, that scares the shit out of me. Like, are you, because as somebody who has worked in journalism and kind of, you know, has this skeptical mindset, I often like to go to AP or to Reuters first because, like you said, I trust them. They're clean. They don't have, they don't editorialize anything. And I can kind of just get to the facts and then I can start reading around the facts based on how different people have reported them. But I can look at sort of just like the purest reporting of the facts first. Are you saying that there's they are starting to be affected by PR companies as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know the exact sort of breakdown for individual newswires because the only studies that have ever really looked this, really looked at this kind of stuff haven't named the newswires because you can understand why a news agency would reporter wouldn't be particularly honest or want to go on record about what they're doing if they are going to be named for it.
Sure.
But the same study from Cardiff University in 2008 found that 75% of news agency reporters admit that they use PR often. And wouldn't be drawn necessarily on what often means, but they're admitting that they use it a lot. It certainly means that there's compromise in there. And I think when you look at that that study, they found that essentially what the study did was look at the five main quality newspapers in the UK and track them over a fortnight. And then, you know, here are all the stories that appeared in these five publications in a fortnight. Where did these stories come from? And then identify the original source. And they found that 60% of the stories came from were either wholly or largely from PR or the newswire. And then 20% contained strong elements of PR or the news agency copy. So around about 80% of stories had were compromised by PR or were from a newswire, which then is compromised by PR. Now, it's hard to track exactly how much of it is compromised because the best PR is almost by definition invisible, because if you know how to do your job well as a PR person, you don't leave your fingerprints on it. Mm. You kind of put the little bits in there that that spin things the right way. And a fantastic illustration of that was if you look at the police in the UK, when they will put out press releases about arrests or kind of other kind of projects that that the police are undertaking, the incidence of the police reports passing into the BBC verbatim was incredibly high. I used to kind of track it. I think it was one or two police departments, police kind of officers in the UK, who pretty much anything they printed wouldn't get changed when it appeared in the BBC.
Wow.
All the facts would be exactly as they were. Now, most of the time, that's not going to be a problem because most of the time the police aren't going to be wrong. But every now and again, you get the shooting of Jean-Charles de Menezes, the Brazilian student who was shot by the police who suspected he was a terrorist. And the police reports after that made out that he was running and jumping over the barriers in the tube and all this kind of stuff, all of which subsequently proved not to be true, but all of which was reported in all the newspapers as the truth because it's what the police said, it's what the source said. So even you can begin to sound conspiracist, but it's important to say that we have to check the facts even from sources that look to be trusted, because they are still it's still possible that they could be compromised or that they could be containing either accidentally or on purpose misinformation. You know, there's no way of rooting it out until you can do the fact checking, and we shouldn't take any sources as being golden, you know, as being untouchable and uncheckable.
No, and especially not the police. I mean, I guess maybe we have more or just as much or more recently, you know, panging experience with that here with the Black Lives Matter movement and with so much police brutality that we've been seeing in the news over the past several years. I can't imagine if, you know, the Trayvon Rice case or these different poor young individuals who were shot by police, if only the police's side of the story were what was being published, we would have a very different perception of exactly what was going on. And when you control the media or you control the story, in many ways, you control everything. You control public opinion. You control political outcomes from that. I mean, having a truly free press is so important to a democracy. And when you start to realize how much of the press is bought and sold, not because of any sort of, you know, mustache twisting conspiratorial meeting that's happening in a darkened room with cigar smoke somewhere, but just because money talks and because people are overworked and sort of under scrutinized, it becomes a recipe for major concern.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, the way that I normally talk about this is to say that if you're looking for a bad guy, it's pretty hard to find one because you have the people who own the newspaper, for example. So someone like Rupert Murdoch, there's lots of reasons why I'm not a big fan of Rupert Murdoch, and I don't think he's been a very positive force for truth. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the main influence he's had over his newspapers, I think the cost cutting is the thing that's had the biggest effect on journalistic standards. It's the reason why people at The Sun were trying to hack the phones of celebrities and crime victims in order to get to a story, partly because their ethics in that newsroom were very loose, but partly because they didn't have the time or the resources to get to that story properly. You know, it's a shortcut to getting facts when you haven't got the time to develop sources and to put stories together in a conscientious and kind of responsible way. When that's kind of when those elements are taken out, you're taking the brakes off a little bit, and you're allowing this kind of to run kind of run rampant in places that aren't helpful. It's the same reason why journalists have ended up doing things like paying the police for information or going through people's bins. They're trying to get shortcuts to a story when they haven't got the time or the resources or the inclination to develop it properly.
Yeah.
So I think, can you blame the people at the top though? Well, they didn't buy a newspaper to be a public good. Rupert Murdoch is not a public service broadcaster. He's a businessman who wants to make money. And for all the things you can say about him, his remit is making money, and he's going to therefore pursue that as his goal in owning a newspaper. And you can say, well, maybe it's the journalists. Well, they're under such pressure from their editors and from the time that they have to spend that if they let through stories because they haven't got the time or the inclination or increasingly the skills to check it, because a lot of the time people come into, let's say, the Daily Mail online, you might be 2 years out of university being shouted at by an editor who's saying, get this stuff published now. I need you to publish this many stories a day. Maybe you'll stay at the Mail Online for a couple of years before moving on to a newsroom that's a bit more conducive to proper journalism. And maybe at that point you think, well, my career can really begin now. But for that 2 or 3 years, what have you perpetrated in terms of the way that truth gets told in the press? You've been part of a system that's designed not to check facts, but really to just sell page views and sell newspapers.
Absolutely.
So I can't really blame the journalists there. And then you can say, well, is it the PR companies? Well, a PR company's job is to get their clients mentioned in the press, to get their clients' message out into the press. They're going to use the tools that are at hand. And you can't necessarily blame them for being good at that. You can blame the system that allows that to flourish unchecked, but it's very hard to blame the PR companies themselves. So it's almost like every little cog in this machine is turning the right way, but the whole machine is going backwards and off a cliff.
I think the real kind of blatant concern here is that we don't know it. You know, it's one thing for it to be happening and for people to be fully aware of it, for it to be out in front. Like when you see advertisements, these kind of advertorial pieces, sponsored content, for example, in an online newspaper and in a print newspaper, where the typeface looks the same, where it's like intentionally being deceptive, and then you'll see in very small print somewhere, this is sponsored content. The more obvious that becomes, if it says this is an ad, you know, then it becomes a little bit easier for people to discern that. I see parallels with a lot of my friends who are YouTubers, or even with some of the work that I do in science journalism. You know, I may land a job where I'm reporting on something and I get paid X amount to report on something, and I can, you know, flex my ethical journalism muscle and make my money that day, even though generally speaking, it's not going to pay that well. And then I might get a job where a big company like a GE or an Intel is actually paying my salary to do something that's overtly sponsored by them. And I have to make sure that I owe my listeners or I owe my viewers the distinction. I have to say, you know, overtly, this is sponsored content, or this is branded entertainment, or I was paid to do this for this company. And in certain cases, it's actually illegal for, you know, a big brand to be involved in some sort of content that could look like journalism without overtly saying, you know, paid for by or brought to you by or sponsored by. And that's kind of where I am more concerned, that we don't have better regulation around situations where if you're just going to write a press release and you don't change anything and you don't do due diligence and actually report on it, shouldn't it say somewhere in the publication, basically written by the press office of Johnson & Johnson, or, you know, whatever, of Chevy Trucks, yeah, or whatever.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this is the thing that really, really sort of fascinates me. And it's something I've been kind of meaning to put down on paper for a while, is that there was a fantastic piece on John Oliver's show a little while ago about sponsored content. I mean, this is sponsored content here, and it's made to look like it's actually a New York Times article, but a company paid the New York Times to print that. Isn't that terrible? This is the erosion of the separation of church and state in terms of journalism, which is between editorial and advertorial kind of thing, or advertising rather. But at the same time, if GE paid a PR company to write that and then gave it to the New York Times, and the New York Times just printed it as it came to them, that's totally fine. Nobody would ever bat an eyelid at that. And so it's almost like the reason that we're outraged by the sponsored content is because they're being honest about who wrote it. they're being honest and saying, we didn't write this. I think it is a genuine problem. And I think where this can have other knock-on effects, it can get very interesting and very, very problematic. And there's been a couple of examples in the UK news that I've managed to find over the years that show where this can actually go. And one of my favourite examples was Michael Gove, when he was the educational secretary in the UK, said in an interview that he needs to change the history curriculum completely. Because survey after survey show that kids are ignorant about history. They don't know basic facts about history. They think Henry VIII was married to some actress. I forget the exact name. But he was saying they don't know who Henry VIII's wives are. They think Sir Walter Raleigh was fictional. They think Sherlock Holmes was real. This just shows that kids today know nothing. And this was obviously quite a nice story for the newspapers to run, because they like to bash the youth of today and sort of run this kind of piece saying, you know, kids think, Delia Smith, it was a TV chef, is married to Henry VIII. But when you when a history teacher, who this didn't gel with her recognition of what it was like teaching history, a lady called Janet Downs, she sent in freedom of information requests to the education secretary saying, you've said survey after survey, tell us this. What surveys are you talking about? And when it came back, he wasn't talking about surveys from universities. He wasn't talking about surveys from think tanks or anything like that. He was talking about, he shared three newspaper articles, one from the Mail Online, which said, challenge Churchill, one in four think that Winston Churchill didn't exist, but Sherlock Holmes did. And he said, there was another one from the Mail Online saying that British children think the Spanish Armada is a national dish, and Sir Walter Raleigh invented the bicycle. Now, looking at those stories came from, first of all, a hotel chain, who had commissioned this survey in order to say, because kids are so astonishingly ignorant about history, why not take advantage of one of our deals this weekend to take your child to a site of historical importance teach your kid about history? It was just an advert for a hotel chain. And the other one about the Spanish Armada and Walter Raleigh was an advert for the Sea Cadets, saying kids know nothing about our naval history, so why not enlist them in the Sea Cadets and let them learn discipline as well as learning naval history? So here you have the education secretary saying, we need to stop kids learning all about... ironically, he was saying, we need to stop kids doing the current history curriculum, which is all about checking sources and how do you know whether a source is true and that kind of stuff. And he wants to go back to facts and figures and rote learning and that kind of stuff. Now, one of the things I looked into is that there's no way that a hotel chain goes out there and asks 2,000 people on the street what they think about history. What they do is they commission a market research company to do it. And there aren't that many market research companies. And it's something is kind of another cog in this whole machine, is the people who feed the information to PR companies. So if you want a survey done as a PR company, and survey stories happen all the time in the press. It's something like 4 or 5 a day in the Daily Mail. In any random fortnight that I've looked, it's always been about 4 or 5 survey-based stories a day. You know, 30% of people say X, or 1 in 5 people say Y about their relationship. And they're all pretty much PR surveys. They're all pretty much just adverts for things like hotel chains. And the way that happens is they go to a market research company who's got an online panel of people. So maybe they'll have 30, 40,000 members. And they'll send an email out to their members and say, there's a new survey available. And you take the survey, you get paid a little bit of money for taking the survey. And that becomes the data that gets used for this 2,000. And as it turns out, the education secretary, both his stories were sourced from the same PR company, one called OnePoll, the same market research company, rather, OnePoll, who I've spent a long time looking at because I was one of their members in their panel to see what it looks like from the other side. And the pressures involved here in terms of how you produce good data are absolutely fascinating. So first of all, you've got 2,000 people in your survey, but only the first 2,000 people get paid. And it's the first 2,000 people to complete your survey. So let's say you've got 16 questions in your survey. It's not the people who think about their answers the most who get paid. It's the people who race through the survey quickest to get to the end first. So you could spend 10 minutes, 15 minutes, half an hour really thinking about all, what do you really think about history? What do you think about kind of, you know, all these different questions they ask you, and get to the end and not be paid a single penny.
Yeah.
Because the person who just clicked the first thing that was in front of their face, click, 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 they get paid all the money. And that wouldn't be too much of a problem, except you only get paid 10 pence or so, 5 pence for every survey. And you're only allowed to cash out when you get to £40. So you're taking 200-300 surveys before you see a single penny. So once you're a couple of surveys in, do you really care what answers you give? Because all you're doing is trying to make a little bit of extra money. And so the moment that you're just trying to race through these surveys and not pay any attention to your answers is the moment that you are very susceptible to a market research company gaming the system and saying, well, I want them to say that kids are ignorant or that people don't know anything about this, or, you know, that their mothers are better chefs than their wives. So I'm going to put the important question, I'm going to put the answer that I want them to give at the top of the list.
Yeah.
And they're going to click that one first because they're not going to care.
Or I'm going to word it in such a way that, the answer that I want them to give is going to sound the most warm, or it's going to have the roundest edges, or it's going to be the most appealing. I mean, that's the other real concern, right, is that there are whole branches of psychology dedicated to psychometrics and how to ensure that you have good inner item consistency and that your surveys are valid and reliable. And it's hard enough to do a good psychological study that's very rigid. And, you know, like big, I think good survey organizations like Gallup or like Pew really try to utilize good science behind how do you poll and how do you poll appropriately and how do you actually get a good cross-section of the population. You know, I can't just have people who need to do it for money, because that right there is going to not be a random sample. And I can't just have individuals who, you know, are over a certain age or who are a certain ethnic background or whatever. You want to have a real random sample. So it's hard enough to do that within organizations that are trying to do that. But organizations that are overtly trying to get an answer that their client would like to see on paper, I mean, how much does that fly in the face of good science and good psychology?
Yeah, I mean, well, typically they'll write the story first and find the data that fits it. I mean, if you talk about getting a good sample, and the sampling is see if you can spot the flaw with this particular sample. So for the ones for the hotel chain and the sea cadets that I just mentioned, that showed that kids know nothing about history, they have screening questions at the start. And if you don't pass the screening questions, you don't get to go into the survey, which means you don't get your opportunity to make 10 pence, which means you've got to wait for another day until you get a few more. So you get further away from your goal of £40, which is far, far away at this point. Mm-hmm. So the screening question will ask, this survey is only for people who have children who are with them right now. Is your child with you right now? If you don't care about the answers that you're going to give in this, you're just trying to make money, you're going to say yes. Whether you've got kids or not, whether your kid is with you or not, you're going to say yes. And even if your kid is with you, this isn't a fair assessment of what your child actually thinks. It's what a child who's willing to sit next to their parent while their parent fills in an online survey might say while sat next to their parent. So you're a million miles away from reality. And so that the likelihood that this question, that these articles that appeared in the Mail even involved surveying 2,000 children is incredibly small. But once you put these stories out there in the world, as a PR company, your job's done. You don't care what happens, because the end of your story, the end of your journey, is getting your client name in the press. But the entire world gets your story from that point onwards. Oof. As a PR company, you're not going to know, and you're probably not even going to necessarily care. You're certainly not going to predict that these stories you put out about kids here not knowing stuff about Winston Churchill and kids here not knowing stuff about Spanish Armada are going to be used by the educational secretary as evidence for why we need to completely change the history curriculum and take us back to a old-fashioned facts and figures way of learning. And I think even if you are that PR company, I don't think you'd even take responsibility for that. But yeah, that's exactly the position we were nearly in, is that the education secretary nearly changed the entire history curriculum based on some assumptions made from some PR adverts, basically, that were talking about children who weren't even taking part in the test in the first place.
Yeah, it's these unintended consequences, because that's what people don't realize. Knowledge is very or information, I should say, is very powerful. Whether there's a lot of knowledge contained in that information is up for debate. And when you put information out there and you put it out there in an authoritative way from what we think of as a legitimate news organization and you state claims, I mean, most people don't look beyond a headline. And even if they do read the article, they're not going to read any supporting documents. They're not going to stop and go, I see that there's a scientist who's quoted here, and I see that there's a politician who's quoted here, and I see that there are facts and figures that come from a quote-unquote study, but I'm not sure I really buy it, so I'm going to go to the source, and I'm going to read the journal article. Like, people just don't do that. They don't have time. The same way that the consumer kind of can't be bothered to fully understand and look at the ramifications of the work, the same way the journalist can't be bothered to do that, obviously the consumer can't be bothered to do that. And you have these horrific unintended consequences, because once something's out there, it's out there. And we do know that there are multiple university peer-reviewed studies that show that when a claim is stated in the press, especially if it has novelty to it, and it takes off like wildfire and it becomes memeified or it, you know, goes viral, if that claim is later found to be not true, the retraction never takes off the same way that the original claim takes off.
Yeah.
So it doesn't even matter if it's true.
We know that.
Yeah,
PR companies know that. PR companies base them.
True.
Some unethical PR companies, certainly some unethical market research companies, base their business model on that fact. And it's why you end up with one of my worst examples of a survey I ever saw. And it was a survey that I took part in when I was trying to understand how it works. And the question one of this survey was, who do you prefer to work for, men or women? And the two answers you were given were men, women. That's it. You don't get to say the gender doesn't play a big role to me.
Yeah.
It doesn't bother me that it depends on what the person is like. You get forced into this binary choice, 50-50, men or women. But you're only in it to make 10 pence. You don't think that you're going to end up in, you don't think about what this is going to end up saying or doing or anything like that. So if you choose one, let's say you choose men, and I've got the screenshots of it, actually. So I always kind of show this in my presentations when I show this to journalism students, to say, this is how you need to, why you need to avoid this kind of stuff. Is that if you say you want to, you prefer working for men, question two is, why do you prefer working for men? And you are given a list of 20 different reasons. So these, and some of the reasons are things like, men are easier to reason with than women. Men are more professional. Men don't have a time of the month.
Oh, wow.
Men have fewer mood swings, and you're forced to choose one of these if you want your 10 pence. And then the next question is even worse, because the next question would be, if you prefer to work for a man, why do you think that women make bad bosses? Now, at no point did you say women make bad bosses. You were forced into a 50-50 choice. And the answers that you were given to choose from for why women make bad bosses, it was things like, they are hormonal, they bitch all the time, they're highly strung. There was one that was just, they lie. That was it. Just women lie. That was one of the answers you could do. And you've got 20 or so different checkboxes here, and you can pick as many as you like, basically, but you've only got to pick from the list that are there. And of course, when you see the headline finding in the newspaper, they just repeat every single one of those options that anyone ticked. So when you see it, it says, well, people say that female bosses are hormonal. They can't leave their personal lives at home. They'll talk about you behind their back. And, you know, they're a nightmare. And even women agree. Now, when you read that story, you think, oh, this must be what people said about their boss. Or there was maybe an interview where they had to write down things about their boss, or they had to write down kind of thoughts that they had. And then we've sifted through and picked out some of the experiences, some of the themes that come up, some of the things that people say. They won't realize that a PR company or a market research company pre-wrote a list of offensive things to say about the gender of your boss, and had you enforced people to choose one of these offensive answers in order to make a little bit of money. And this ended up being an advert for a press release rather for a recruitment company. And basically all they were trying to say was, hey, what's your boss like? Do you enjoy working for your boss? Maybe you should think about getting a new job. That was the entire angle, nothing more than that. And I honestly think if they'd have said that male bosses were worse than female bosses, they would have had a whole other story ready to go. They didn't care about the line on the press release, really. All they wanted to do is get their name out there. And they probably would have had versions in both directions. If you're asking a 50-50 question, it doesn't take much to prepare two answers, at which point you're not data gathering, you're just looking for statistical justification for running this story that you already wanted to write.
Yeah, no.
But this appears in the Daily Mail, but then it appears in The Guardian. It appeared on talk radio. So they're now just pointing out this headline in the Daily Mail. So we don't even get the bit 4 or 5 paragraphs in where it says who commissioned the survey that allows you to see, oh, I can see what their angle was here. So it's divorced from the source of it now. So if you want to try and even find the original data, you can't. And of course, the PR company doesn't print the original data, because that's, as far as they're concerned, client confidentiality. Is that, well, this is proprietary information. The client's paid for this. We can't just publish all of our data in this way. We're not allowed to do that because it's the client's bought it. And then the worst thing is, in 3 months' time, there's a magazine article that happens to mention female bosses. And as a little tidbit, it throws in there, oh, and it was only a couple of months ago that we found that 44% of people think female bosses are liars. And now we're so far divorced from it that you've seen it repeated, not just in the first story, not just on the talk radio, not just on local radio, but 3 months later in a magazine and a year later in another news story. It's now become part of culture. It's now become a truism, but it was generated purely as an advert by a PR company who had no interest in the ethics of what they're putting out there and no interest in the ramifications of their stories.
I know it's tough. Like, being a skeptic is a full-time job in so many ways, and you're constantly having to flex your sort of critical thinking muscle and really put a lot of effort into what you read and what you think and how you come to the conclusions that you come to. But I'm sure a lot of people are thinking after this conversation, like, how do I trust anything? How do I know where to get good information? How do I know when I read a headline that it's not all, you know, some nefarious backroom decision that was made about this is the narrative I'm trying to put out there and let's just figure out how to get that in the news? I mean, is there any hope for people who are listening who are like now very disillusioned by the media as a whole?
I think there's a couple. I mean, I haven't got an easy solution, unfortunately, because if I had, I'd be a millionaire at this point, having fixed the entire news media service and probably prevented you having a certain guy in charge right now. But I think there are little tools that you can use to be aware, the little sort of tricks. One of them, ironically enough, I don't know whether I came up with this rule or whether I read it somewhere else, and it's called the fourth paragraph law. And it's something I always sort of tell anybody about whenever I give talks on this subject. And the idea is that if you see a company name mentioned round about the fourth paragraph of a news story, there's a very strong chance that that's the company that paid for this story in the first place.
Wow.
And it's a very rough rule of thumb, but it does actually make sense. And it comes from, if you understand kind of a little bit about how stories are written. And if you go back to a time before kind of word layouts, when it was literally, when cut and paste was literally a pair of scissors and a paste brush kind of thing, when you'd have to kind of compose layouts of newspapers using the paper itself on templates and stuff. If you were given the main story on that news page for that day, and you were given kind of like 1,000 words or whatever to write about this particular story, and then a more important story came along, your editor needs to be able to very quickly trim a load of your copy out and shunt you to a sidebar that's only got 400 words in it. And one of the ways to do that is that and you'll know this as a journalist yourself, obviously you write a story kind of indexing the most important details towards the top. So rather than writing it chronologically or anything like that, unless you're doing a feature piece, if you're doing a normal news piece, you put the most important detail at the start, second most important next, maybe a quote from the most important person in the story next, and you'll structure it that way. Because that means that an editor can just come along, and if they need to lose 200 words of your story, they'll lose the bottom couple of paragraphs, and your story should pretty much hold together that way. So if you are a PR company who wants to get your company name in the press, you need to make sure that company name appears high enough up to escape that cut from any judicious editor just getting rid of a load of copy. But you can't put it in the first line, because then you've got a story that says a recruitment company has said that women make terrible bosses, and you've totally undone the magic of it. You know, you've made this very clearly an advert and it loses its newsiness. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes much more obvious to people. So the fourth paragraph is kind of the sweet spot between low enough down to still be passable as news to the people who kind of skim read it, but high enough up to escape the cut. So the fourth paragraph rule is kind of a rule of thumb that I use. As I say, I don't know if I invented this or not, but I tried to Google to find out if it appeared anywhere else, if it's ever been described anywhere. And I found this really good article giving a good illustration of it. And I thought this might be where I got it from. And I scrolled to the very bottom and it said, if you need to know more about this, look up Michael Marshall, who invented it. So ironically, now I've kind of accidentally become the owner of this thing that even I don't know if I invented it or not. So, ironic for the topic in hand is that I've actually churned in my ownership of
it. That's hilarious.
So that's one. The other thing I would say is check the same story in multiple different sources, especially sources that come from conflicting sides of the spectrum in terms of politics, that type of thing, or in terms of quality. Because if you see enough corresponding information, then you'll get some hint that there's something that there's some kind of work being done there. Some of some news organizations are better than others. So things like The Guardian tend to be pretty good in the UK. The Times tend to be pretty good, even though they're Murdoch owned, essentially because Murdoch runs The Times at a loss in order for him to be able to say, see, I care about journalism, I make a loss on The Times. And then you look at all of his other newspapers and he runs them into the ground and makes huge profits on them. So that's kind of his business model. But it does mean that The Times is often well-funded and got fairly conscientious staff in lots of places there. Take everything in the news as provisional. I mean, go back to sources as often as you can. And if you can't find a source, then leave it with that bit of a question mark. I mean, you don't have to commit all the way to follow a story to sort of hold it as provisionally true. Try never to be too married to it. And I think if there's one thing we've seen of late, it's that people get incredibly married to stories that they agree with and refuse to countenance any refutation of them, regardless of how strong that refutation is. Especially doubt the stories that you believe the most. Doubt the stories that are tailor-made to fit your worldview, because you'll have the least ability to assess the veracity of those independently because they tell you what you want to hear. You know, you instantly go away. If someone says, well, here's this thing about how great Trump is, you would instantly go away and trying to find a million places that prove it wrong. Mm. But if you read a story that says this is how terrible Trump is, you don't necessarily break your neck trying to find a reason to disagree with it.
No, it's true. And, you know, one thing that I think you do so well is you have this fun blog called Bad PR. I'm seeing the Mail online, like the Daily Mail, like really, really featured heavily here, where you will take these stories that are obviously paid for stories, and then you will kind of bring them down. You headline them really great. Like, Wi-Fi is more important than booze or sex, says Wi-Fi company. Let me find another good one. This one's good. Shopping on the high street is stressful, says online marketplace. Really getting down to the root of like, what is the story trying to say and who paid for this story? And I think it's just brilliant. It's absolutely genius because once it becomes so obvious, you can really see through it. But without that sort of twist, it's tough for most people to see through them. So I appreciate that you do this as sort of an exposé.
Well, it's kind of, I think of it as kind of raising the subtext to be the actual text, because when you see a story that says, you know, men gossip more than women was kind of the headline, I think it was, or maybe it was the other way around. As I say, in these kind of gender-based stories, you can either conform to a stereotype and get everybody going, see, I told you. Or you can flip the stereotype and have everyone going, oh, I didn't realize that was true. So it doesn't matter which of those two you do. You get just as many page reads either way. Mm. But you had this kind of men versus women story. Or it happens all the time, these men versus women type stories, because they're such easy templates to write as a PR person. You can just very easily fit your data around that. You've got a pre-existing narrative. Now, you can either agree with that narrative and share it on Facebook and do exactly what they want you to do by kind of taking this as if it's true. Or you can be the good skeptic and say, well, actually, here's all the reasons this is wrong. And here's what they missed in the data. And actually, women are great in this way here and all this kind of thing. But on both cases, what you're doing is kind of sharing the story and sharing this and keeping the subtext. You're still engaging with the narrative of it, even positively or negatively. It's kind of generating the same amount of heat for them. They don't really care which way you go on it. So the thing they really don't want you to do is to just point out it's an advert. And pretty much leave it at that. Is that, oh, this is an advert for this company, the end. That's the last thing they want you to do. Because if you see that story about women being terrible bosses, if you see that and it's a full-page ad in the Daily Mail saying, your boss is terrible, get a new job. We are this recruitment company, we'll get you a new job. You look at that and you go, well, obviously they're going to say that. Isn't that kind of a bit gauche and tacky that they put their message out that way? It's really obvious. But if you see it as this story that kind of is dressed up as kind of pseudo sociology, it's got that kind of water cooler type thing. And I'm going to talk to my friends about it. If you don't spot that it's an advert, then you might start chatting about it and have these kind of conversations and pass the information around. So yeah, highlighting that it is an advert is the thing they don't want you to do, because it's the truth behind the curtain on it, really. And that's why I enjoy this kind of format of bringing the subtext to the very top and pointing out what's really going on with this story.
It's so funny. I mean, it's so blatant. And then when you really compare the headline that that's published to your headline, here's one: people get viruses and infections, says cleaning product company. And then, of course, what is the actual headline? Are women the weaker sex? Man flu myth debunked as females more likely to take sick days. Like, there's all these layers of garbage on top of it, but really they're like, hey, you need to buy our bleach. You know, it's insane.
Well, there was a great one one of my favorite ones to point out, and it's because there's a lot of sexism in these kind of things, and it's largely, I don't think it's because the PR industry is sexist per se. I think it's just that sexism is a very easy way of generating attention grabbing headlines. Yeah. I mean, there probably is a hell of a lot of sexism and misogyny and all sorts of stuff right throughout the media anyway, and certainly the way that the tabloids operate. And you only have to take one infinite scroll down the right-hand side of the Daily Mail online to see that that's true. But I don't think it's overt sexism and misogyny that's driving it. I think it's commercial noose or commercial kind of intention, is that you play this kind of sexist card and it'll get your attention. But sometimes the sexism does go in the opposite direction. It's kind of a minority. But there was one of my favorite examples was one that said, the headline in the Daily Mail was, think he knows you, think again, how millions of men don't know their partner's dress size, date of birth, or even eye color. And the story paints this kind of picture of millions of British men are astonishingly ignorant about their partner's basic characteristics. And then later in the story, kind of lists all the characteristics that you should know about your partner, saying that your relationship is in jeopardy. You know, some of these relationships are going to fall apart, and it's largely because you don't know your partner's clothes size or bra size or shoe size or favorite perfume. And then there's a line, fourth paragraph: according to a survey of 2,000 men buying scent for their female partner at the perfume shop, they didn't know these kind of things about them. And when you look at this story, you think, well, why would the perfume shop want to tell men that their relationships will fall apart if they don't know what perfume their wife wears? And specifically, the story was published on February the 9th.
Wow.
5 days before Valentine's Day.
Genius.
Nice and obvious there. Just, and it's so clear when you look at it. So I absolutely love this. One of my favorite stories as well. I mean, I could go on literally forever because I've got a million of these stories and my website contains a million of them. But there was a fantastic one about how the average kitchen in the UK is the subject of, you know, something like 500 arguments, 1,000 heart-to-heart discussions, and 7 sex romps. And it's got this picture of a woman there kind of looking all kind of seductive to sort of say essentially that your kitchen will get you laid. And it was the whole story was a survey of 3,000 people commissioned by Siemens Home Appliances to mark the launch of a new fridge freezer. So this new fridge freezer, this new refrigerator is so amazing, it'll get you laid. But what I love about this story is this is actually a terrible example, because if your company name is Siemens, you shouldn't run a story based on sex, because it just sends the wrong message. The wrong associations are there.
Yeah, but yeah. Sex sells. Didn't you know that?
Well, that's true. I'll tell you my last kind of the most depressing, one of the most depressing stories I ever saw. And it's kind of really an example of this. I started seeing a while back in the news, I think, when was this? Maybe about 2012, something in that kind of area. Certain business names being mentioned. It was a couple of sort of businesses coming up. And it all kind of started with a couple of stories about the holidays and what it's like going abroad on holiday. And so the first story was in the Mail Online saying that more than 40% of women under the age of 30 admit to having a one-night stand when they're on holiday. That was kind of the line. And The Sun ran a similar kind of one saying that women under 30 are more likely to sleep with a stranger if they're on holiday. And then a couple of weeks later, there was a story in the Daily Express saying that essentially everyone's sex lives have been dampened this summer because it's raining so much that nobody feels sexy. And all of these stories, and there was a couple of them came out, they were all by a company called MissTravel.com, which is a travel dating website where women who want a free holiday can sign up and men who have money to take a stranger on holiday can sign up, and this website will match them. And so it's essentially a way of saying, when you read back those stories, it's a way of saying to men, if you stay at home, you are not going to have sex. But if you take a stranger on holiday, she'll almost certainly sleep with you.
Wow. So long as it's not raining, so started, apparently.
So long as it's not raining, exactly. Yeah. So don't take her on holiday to Manchester, essentially, yeah. Now, you look at the business model of MissTravel.com, sort of pairing up women who want things bought for them with men who want female company. You get into interesting business models there. And if everyone goes into that arrangement with their eyes completely open, that's fine. But having the newspapers paint this as kind of advertising this as a way of saying, oh, well, here's what you should be doing. You know, it's not saying this is a borderline escort thing. This is just saying, take someone away. Maybe they'll sleep with you. It's this kind of thing, really. That was owned by a guy called Brandon Wade. He owns two other businesses, one called whatsyourprice.com, which is an auction dating website where men with money get to bid on the women and the one who pays the most gets to keep her, which is, again, pretty icky in terms of a business model. And then there's one called Seeking Arrangement, which is a sugar daddy dating site. And this one's actually regularly mentioned in the press. Anytime you see these stories of women saying they have sugar daddies, it's always just an advert for this company. And they're really quite prevalent. And so I decided to look for, I think it was 2012, I think it was. I decided to look for every piece of coverage I could find on Google News between January the 1st and December 31st, 2012, in the UK press, mentioning either one of those three business names or the guy who's the CEO, a guy called Brandon Wade. And what I found was, across the British press, 49 stories in the 11 months that I was actually looking at. So it wasn't quite 12 months. So 49 stories, including 30 that were in the Daily Mail alone. So the Daily Mail published more than one story per fortnight throughout 2012 for companies that were essentially prostitution companies. Jeez. And this was at the time that the Daily Mail were also running a very, very high profile anti-pornography campaign, which they announced with the Fight Back for Decency Starts Here. So exactly the same year that they were running this high-level anti-pornography campaign, they also ran 30 adverts for essentially a prostitution website. And the thing is, they would have no idea that that's what they did, because they wouldn't have checked the stories. They just get in these press releases, they've got interesting headlines, they publish them.
Wow.
And just to tell you how bad it could get, this is the kicker to the story. This was 2012. Brandon Wade tried to put out a lot of other press releases for his businesses. Not all of them got published. One of them that didn't get published was in July 2012. And the quote from it, I've actually got in front of me, I can read it out to you. In the event of a tragedy like the Dark Knight Massacre, who would you want by your side on a first date? If you're holding out for a hero, dating someone who is generous but not necessarily wealthy may be the difference between life and death.
What?
During the Dark Knight Massacre, three men lost their lives to save the lives of their girlfriend. But if you're on a first date and you've only just met, men who make between $80,000 a year and $150,000 a year are more likely to take a bullet for you on their first date. So this is a guy who sees a guy go into a cinema in Aurora, Colorado during the Dark Knight film kind of opening and kill a bunch of strangers. And this guy, Brandon Wade, thinks that's a good opportunity for me to advertise my essentially prostitution businesses.
Oh my God.
And this is the guy who gets published once a week in the British press in 2012. I ran the same check on the news recently, and in 2015, I think it was, or 2016, one of the two, just as many published stories, one a week roughly in the British press. This is what the whole system is set up to propagate without question.
That is horrifying.
Yeah, I tell the most depressing stories with this. But what fascinates me is that when you really start looking into this, and you get to that just by essentially reading every news story for each day. I have an RSS that delivers me every news story from all the national newspapers in the UK. And if you skim the headlines, you learn to recognise which ones are likely to be PR. Read those stories and you start spotting these patterns. And before you know it, you can start putting these ridiculous stories together. I guarantee there's more just as dark, just as bleak stories than that. But it's just once you start looking into this, the more you look in, the more broken the system gets and the more hard it is to find who's responsible for the breakage.
Yeah, it's tough. You know, I think that if there is an outlet that you are really interested in, sort of science journalism is a little bit niche or niche, however you want to say that. And so it helps, you know, when I'm doing a lot of science coverage, I know that there are certain journalists and certain bloggers, like specific bylines that I trust more than others. And so once you start to really understand or know the depths of a certain area in journalism, you can start kind of picking and choosing. You can read different articles by different people, but then when you see that it's covered by somebody who has a really good track record, you can say, okay, what's their take on it? Oftentimes I like to read at least science journalism where debunking is an active part of it. Kind of, this is what everybody is publishing. Let's break it down. That I really appreciate. Unfortunately, that's a minority of what's out there. And most of us who get our news from feed, like from Twitter or from Facebook, who just kind of like to scroll through and sort of look at the headlines. Oh, that's interesting. Oh, that's interesting. Oh, I might want to know more about that, so I'll read this one article out of 20. It becomes problematic. And of course, these companies and these organizations know that that's how we consume. And so I guess the sort of message here is the same message that we're always touting, which is work on your skepticism, you know, develop your baloney detection. And this is just another reason why it's so important to be a skeptic, and it's so important to think critically and to look for evidence and to just have a rational perspective. When don't take everything you read at face value, you know, oh, just because it was published on the internet does not mean it was true. It's actually probably more likely that it's not holy truth. And so we've got to remember that, you know.
And we also have to pay for journalism we care about.
That's
as well.
That's true, because, too. And we have to support it. You know, we have to support good good podcasters. We have to support good independent organizations. And we also have to support longstanding institutions that don't have the financial support that they used to. You know, if you trust the New York Times, you need to pay for a subscription. That's absolutely true. So Marsh, you've got this amazing blog that's like so funny and also so informative, badpr.co.uk. That's where you can find it. You're also doing amazing work with the Good Thinking Society. You're doing amazing work with QED, which you can learn more about at qedcon.org. Is there anything that you want to announce? Is there anything that you want to make sure everybody who's listening knows about in the meantime?
I guess there's one other thing that I'll mention, which is kind of another of the side projects that I do in my spare time.
Yeah.
And I have a podcast called Be Reasonable, which is something I'm it's one of my favorite things that I do, because I think it's conversations that aren't happening anywhere else in skepticism, where each month I interview someone who is completely on the other side of an issue to a skeptic. So I've spoken to people who are flat earth believers. I've spoken to people who think that they can give up all food and water and live exclusively on kind of pranic energy from the air around them. And instead of having a conversation where we get at each other's throats, or where I shout or get aggressive, we just have a polite exploration of why we disagree. And in that time, I try and ask kind of firm, slightly challenging questions, but keep up a civic discourse, and to try and get to understand why would somebody hold these views? What do they think supports their views? Mm-hmm. And so we've had shows in the past where we've had someone who pickets abortion clinics, goes to three different cities in the month, stands outside of abortion clinics, handing women baby clothes on the way in. Horrible thing to do. Absolutely terrible thing to do. But if I'd have shouted at him the way that anybody might want to shout at that kind of person, we never understand what's really going on with that guy. We never understand what we're up against, who we're arguing with, what arguments they might use to convince other people that they're right. And we may never actually get to a point where we can diffuse these beliefs. So yeah, that's kind of a show that I do that I'm really happy about. And it's actually been on hiatus since April last year, but I've actually got it back underway now. And the first episode should be out kind of the 19th of January. So depending when this kind of show goes out. So it's out, and it's with a guy who believes not only is the world flat, but it exists underneath a dome. Space is just projected onto that dome, and there's nothing, we have no idea what's beyond
what?
That. And every government in the world knows about it and has been covering it up since the 30s.
That's incredible.
So he was an interesting fella.
Wow.
He was really interesting. He believes in, he told me at one point that he believes in all the conspiracy, he used to believe in all the conspiracy theories. And I said to him, has there ever been a conspiracy theory that you used to believe that you no longer believe in? And he said, actually, there is. He said, I no longer believe in the face on Mars, the Richard Hoagland, there's civilizations on Mars. And I said to him, yeah, that's because you don't believe in Mars anymore. You've come to a point where you no longer believe. That doesn't count.
At least there's some internal consistency there. That is insane. Oh my God, I'm fascinated. And yes, this episode will be coming out in 1 week, which means that that your first episode back will already be on the air, so people can already go to it. Where would they find that?
You've got a merseysideskeptics.org.uk, and there's a podcast kind of tab there. You can find it. It's called Be Reasonable. Or if you search Be Reasonable on iTunes, there's 40 episodes there. We've interviewed, I say, people from all sorts of background. I interviewed the guy who invented Miracle Mineral Supplement, the industrial bleach that they sell to people with cancer and autism. I had an interview with him. That was an interesting hour and a bit of my life. So yeah, You can hear all sorts of explorations of the unknown, the ridiculous, and the dangerous.
Fascinating. Well, before we go, because I've taken so much of your time and it's like dinner time for you, and I want to make sure you can eat, I do close every episode asking my guests the same two questions, and I would love to do the same with you because I'd be fascinated to hear your answers. Are you down with that?
Okay.
Awesome.
Yes, go
okay.
for it.
So the first question is, when you look to the future in whatever context that matters to you right now, whether it's your own personal future, the future of your family, or the future of humanity at large and, you know, the globe at large, one, what concerns you the most? What keeps you up the most at night? What are you the most worried about? And then two, on the flip side of that, what are you hopeful and, you know, optimistic for?
Okay, so in terms of what concerns me, I think the biggest thing that concerns me is our ability to tribalize mm-hmm. and to go into our own kind of little not just the echo chamber rather, because I think that's kind of been repeated to a point where it's almost lost all meaning. But our seeming need to constantly put ourselves into little categories. And I think even going back to the conversation we just had about the media, I think even that's a good example of it. So if you go back to when people used to buy newspapers, they'd always buy the same newspaper. And then news went online and suddenly you could read all of the news. And then people would start finding the online spaces that agreed with them and just start looking at those. And then social media came around and everyone was sharing all sorts of stuff into your feed and you get all of the news. And then you started cultivating your friends based on the fact that they agreed with you. So we keep siloing ourselves off and we see this. It seems like the world is at a place of partisanship and division more than ever in an era where we are so connected, we're so far apart, Trump and Brexit and things happening in Europe. Mm. So that worries me a lot that we continually find ways to use technologies that are so fantastic at bringing people together to just drive ourselves further apart and backwards. But I think I'm also very optimistic. And I do think that people are, I think the majority of people are genuinely good. The majority of people want to do the right thing. They want to, they want the world to be better. They want to be nice to people. The overwhelming majority, the people who are incredibly nasty are often the loudest and can often sound like they are more numerous just because of their volume. But I think they are very much outnumbered. And to a degree, their volume is kind of a testament to the fact that they're worried about being outnumbered. So I do think people want to do the right thing when given the right information. It's just the ability to give people the right information in a setting where they're likely to listen and in a way that they are likely to want to hear it. And I think the more that we're able, as skeptics, when we're talking to people we disagree with, to think about the way that we talk to people and how we structure that dialogue, how we try and be approachable, how we try not to just be the aggressive, evil, nasty person who keeps shouting at them that their favorite thing is nonsense, that keeps calling them idiots. I don't think that gets us anywhere. I think the more we can think about how we can be sympathetic, empathetic, and understandable and relatable, the better we'll get. But I do think we're trending in the right direction on a long enough timeline. It's just there'll be troughs along the way. And I think it feels like we're in a bit of a trough right now.
Well, that is, you know, positive. It is promising. And I think it's also very, very good advice that we don't quite hear enough of within the skeptic community, which is like, don't be a dick. Don't be a snob. You're never going to get through to anybody unless you listen to where they're coming from. And you know, the empathy goes a long way. And I think it's important that we remember that because we don't always. That's probably our biggest downfall as skeptics as a whole. Is that we tend to sort of operate a little bit on a pedestal. And I think that we have to be really careful about that. And I think it's important to point
that
out.
I mean, I don't hold it against people, I think, though. I think because it's I don't want to sound like I'm just having a go at people, because I would also say I totally understand why people like that, because in our day-to-day life, we find people that we love, people that we have to work with, people that we bump into, hold these views that are so pseudoscientific that are so wrong. And it's very hard to be able to say to those people, you know, that you're wrong about these things. So when you find skepticism, it's dead easy to go, oh, thank God, finally there's all these people around me who are right about this issue. I thought I was alone. Thank God there's actually a whole community out there. But it's kind of how to temper that enthusiasm before it turns too sharp-edged.
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Marsh, this was so much fun. It was so much fun chatting. I want to make sure that people who are interested in saying hello, saying that they were excited to hear from you and who want to follow your work can find you online. Where are you most active in social media?
So you can follow me on Twitter, which is Mr. M. Marsh. And you can also follow the Good Thinking Society, which is Good Thinking Sock on Twitter. Occasionally, I'll put bad PR stuff up when I go through these bursts of doing it. But if you follow me on Twitter under Mr. M. Marsh, you'll see it all there.
Awesome. And you guys, if you're interested in QED, follow the website, follow the news. Hopefully, you'll be able to come one of these years and meet all of the incredible Merseyside skeptics and also the Manchester skeptics and people from literally around the world. It's such a wonderful experience. Marsh, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Kara. I've enjoyed this a huge amount.
Of course, it was a ton of fun. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.